We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, my name is Melanie, and I am an alcoholic. Melanie W, to be exact. My sobriety date is 2/19/2016. If you had told me 7+ years ago that I would be sober, that I would have days strung together of not using alcohol, I would have said, there's no way. There's no way that that could possibly have happened. This program has given me a completely new life. And in thinking about my sobriety journey before speaking with you, I was just thinking about all the ways that sobriety and recovery has changed my life and what the program has done for me. And just giving gratitude to that and being grateful for what I have. And every day I see alcoholism in an active way because I'm a bartender. And it's really a way for me to stay where I am and stay sober because I remember what it was like. I remember, you know, the incomprehensible demoralization, waking up and not knowing if I'd driven home, waking up and not knowing what happened last night, blacking out, not knowing what I said to people, missing work, all these different things. But I guess I'll just backtrack to partially my childhood because I think some of that, you know, it doesn't make me an alcoholic, but I think sometimes people relate to different ways that they were raised and sometimes how alcohol manifests generationally. So I was raised in a suburb of Los Angeles. So I live in Los Angeles County. I still do to this day. Always a lot of things to do. I was raised in a middle-class family. I had everything that I needed, but there was a lot of... I saw this recently, and it pretty much like reflected how I felt. While I was rejected by one parent, I was emotionally abandoned by the other. So my father was a rageaholic. My mom, in my opinion, is an alcoholic. And I just always felt like I had to be quiet. I had to be silent. I had to be still. I had to hide. I had to stay in my room like a little doll and not be seen and not be heard. You know, I couldn't express my emotions. And that's kind of how it was for me. And I remember watching my mom in the living room as a child from a very young age. She would just sit in the dark and she would drink this thing. I don't know what it was. When I was a lot younger, I didn't know what it was, but I know she liked it. I knew that she liked it, and she would drink it every night, and she would sit in the dark by herself, which for a child is kind of terrifying. I remember at around, I want to say maybe age 6, I asked her what was in that glass. What was that was so mystifying and that I wanted to try some of it. And she gave me a sip of it. I remember thinking, this is so gross. Why does she drink that? And then not thinking about it again, but just kind of being left to my own devices in my room as a child. And just trying to be like a goody two shoes. And I kind of stayed that way, trying to be like a very quiet child. I performed a lot. So that was my way, I think, of getting out whatever emotions I had. I would sing, I would dance, I performed a lot. But besides that, I feel like I was mainly hidden. And in junior high and high school, I just tried to be the good child, the goody two shoes. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I didn't have sex until way later. I didn't get the best grades, but overall, I was a pretty good kid. I also remember just feeling less than. I think a lot of us who are alcoholics and or addicts, we have this feeling of less than. And I remember being very insecure about everything, not feeling smart, not feeling pretty, not feeling talented, feeling fat. I will mention, before I started drinking, I very much had an issue with an eating disorder. And I think this happens to many women and even some men in program. I think food was my first addiction, where it just numbed me out. I could just space out and forget everything until, you know, later when I discovered alcohol, that it could do the job even faster. So throughout high school and college, I didn't really drink. I will mention one time, this is probably going to sound pretentious, but I remember I'm an only child. My parents took me to France, and we were on this tour, those tour buses. And there was a night where we went to like a cabaret, and I was 15 years old and I looked older. And in France, I think it's more acceptable for younger people to drink with their family. And I remember having a glass of wine and just feeling an instant change. Like, oh my gosh, I'm beautiful. I'm smart. I feel so sophisticated. I feel all these things that I'd never felt before. And this kind of should have been an alarm bell. I remember there was another glass of wine and it had a fly in it. And I remember drinking that glass of wine as well. I didn't care if there was a fly in it because I wanted more of that feeling. That's just something that has kind of stuck out to me as I've gone on this journey of recovery. But I didn't really drink until I was about 21, because I realized whatever I was doing was not working for me. I didn't like being the introverted, quiet, shy person that I felt like all the time. And I remember I was in this musical, and there was this girl who was so beautiful to me and so fun. And one night she asked me to come out with her to a nightclub. And so we went to this club, and I remember trying to keep up with her drink wise. And I remember having the best time. We had the best time dancing and talking to guys and all this stuff. But that night, I ended up getting sick and nauseous and throwing up. I think this is a commonality among most of us in the recovery world, that, or in the alcoholism world, that it didn't matter that I threw up and that I got sick, because the next day I wanted to do the exact same thing. I wanted to have that feeling again of just being on top of the world and feeling weightless and free, just free. That's how I felt when I drank. That was around age 22. And then my drinking progressed rapidly. I was the binge drinker. I could outdrink the guys. I still kept hanging out with the same girl because she was fun and she drank like me. And at age 23, I ended up getting a DUI. I had no business driving. I ended up blowing 3 times the legal limit. This was 22 years ago, and I still remember the conversations I had with the sheriffs. I remember questions that they asked me. I remember everything that I told them. I remember them not believing that I blew that much as far as alcohol in my system. And they ended up taking me to the hospital because I was a lot more alert than they would have expected. And so that should have been a huge sign to me that I was going to have some issues with alcohol. So I got that DUI, and it was almost like a badge of honor to me. And I think for most of us who have alcoholic tendencies, it is a badge of honor to be able to outdrink other people, or maybe even like I would brag about how much alcohol I had in my system when I got pulled over. And I think about that now and I just cringe, and I say to myself, I could have killed somebody. I could have killed myself, because now I do know many people who have died from accidents like that. So from there, that was a little bit of a wake-up call. But again, I don't know if I mentioned, I started bartending when I was 21, which was kind of odd because I didn't really drink then. But then as time progressed, like I said, my alcoholism kind of escalated where I was drinking more and more. And being in the bar world, you start to compare yourself to other people. You start to really normalize binge drinking. I would say to myself, well, I'm not as bad as this person. So if I'm as bad as that person, then that's when I really need to stop. Or this person did this and I haven't done that yet. So I'm not really an alcoholic, or I don't drink every day. Because at this point, I didn't drink every day. But when I did drink, I drank a lot. And one of my jobs, I remember being able to drink at work and almost thinking of it as brushing it aside because it wasn't, quote unquote, as much as I normally drink. So to me, it wasn't like drinking, even though I'd have probably 4 to 5 shots at work a night, I would say. But it just was normalized so much. All my coworkers were drinking excessively. I will also mention at this point, I remember watching my general manager of the bar that I worked in. He would come into work and he would be shaking so badly. And I'd never seen anybody shake that badly. And I would remember he would come behind the bar and he would put down a glass, or I would have to do it, or someone else would have to do it. And we would pour him a vodka, which is like the cheapest vodka in the bar, like a triple shot. And I would watch him down it, and I would watch him instantly come back to life. It blew my mind. And I remember looking at him, and I don't know if I really, truly, consciously took it in and said to myself, I'm not stopping drinking until I'm like that. But I do have this sense of that was the example of when I knew it was bad. And to be honest, that's exactly where I was when I ended up getting sober. So to kind of backtrack, I worked in bars. I was around a lot of alcoholism. This is actually the first time I ever met somebody. I had a coworker who was sober. I remember asking her if she could try something. And she said, I can't have anything at all to drink. I'm sober. And it blew my mind that she couldn't have anything. And she was actually an example to me of when I got sober later. So we never know who we're making an impression on. So I just kind of tried to do a balancing act, and it worked for a while of working a lot. I always have multiple jobs. At this time, I think I had 3 jobs. I always had 2 to 3 jobs bartending. So I would work very hard. And when I played hard, I played really hard. But it was just kind of went this way from my late 20s to my early 30s, just this balancing act. And I will say I did get involved in another program. Like I said, I had eating issues. And so that was kind of my first introduction to the 12 steps. I didn't end up staying in there, but it always made an impression on me. And I was always kind of worried that I would be an alcoholic or that I was an alcoholic. It was always looming there. Kind of as time progressed, it just kind of got worse and worse. And so now, as many of us do, it just got to a point of, you know, now I'm drinking liquor at home, which I didn't really used to do all the time. I would maybe have wine at home sometimes or beer at home, but I would not really drink liquor at home, because in my mind that's when you become an alcoholic. So now I'm having bottles of liquor at home, and now I'm waking up and not feeling great at all. And now I need to have a drink before I go to work. it started off as beer before work, and then now I'm drinking liquor before work. Now I'm drinking at work where I'm not even supposed to be drinking liquor and like hiding it. My life just started kind of falling off the rails, and I started backing away from my friends. I started not wanting to see them as much. I wanted to hide how much I was drinking. If there wasn't alcohol there, then I wasn't going. Some of them knew and some of them didn't really have a clue. I just started not wanting to be around my friends at all. And I missed many things. I missed weddings. I couldn't show up for things. I couldn't show up for holidays with people. I couldn't show up for birthdays. I couldn't show up for anything unless there was total alcohol there, concerts or, you know, baseball games where alcohol is accepted, and to drink, I would say to binge drink. Otherwise, I wanted to hide and keep away from my friends. I didn't want them to know. I didn't want my parents to know. And then at this time, I felt so lonely that I started hanging out with lower companions. And at that point, in my mind, I was a lower companion too. I started hanging out with men who were addicted themselves, not necessarily to alcohol, other substances, because who else is going to go to the bar with me at 10 a.m. in the morning the way that I wanted to? I was completely codependent and like always had to have somebody there with me. And a lot of times those people were very abusive to me. It just kind of started coming out to my friends. They realized what was happening. Some of them were very aware of what was happening. I had always been proud of the fact that I'd never been in a domestic violence type of situation with any men at all. And now I suddenly, because I'm inebriated all the time and half the time I don't know what's going on, I'm allowing myself to be treated like this. A couple of my friends did an intervention. Like one of them, God bless her and her husband, he's a police officer. They told me, they said, you are going to make a police report. And I said, no, I'm not. And they said, yes, we are taking you to, you know, give a police report. And that was kind of a wake up call for me. I don't think that I'd seen them in a while. And after we did the police report, I insisted that we go to a Mexican restaurant and have margaritas because I'm an alcoholic. And they said that they just watched the light go out. They had just watched the light go out of my eyes. I remember having a conversation on the phone with the friend who took me to file the police report. And she said to me, why don't you try to stop drinking? You know, why don't you try to drink a little bit less? And I'll never forget where I was sitting, or, you know, I was aware enough. I remember this moment. And this was the first time that I believe this was step one for me. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I said to her, I can't stop drinking. I think I'm an alcoholic. And her response was actually very loving. And she said, I am so relieved to hear you say that. And for me, I think in that moment, that was a relief for me that I'd given up the secret that I felt like I was hiding. I could admit it to other people who had similar addictions, but I could never admit it to my friends. And I knew once I did that, the jig was up, and I knew that I had to start doing something about it. I will also say at this time, I remember waking up every single day and it was like Groundhog Day. I remember looking at myself in the mirror and saying, I have to get sober and I have to go to AA, and I don't know how to do that. And I think this was my moment. And this is honestly, when I like to talk about a higher power, because whether I believed it or not, at this time, I was completely did not believe in any higher power at all, but he believed in me. I think this is the moment when my higher power just gave me grace and the ability to somehow put all of my affairs in order, for as out of it as I was, as drunk as I was all the time, my higher power made this possible, where I admitted that I was an alcoholic to my friend. I started looking into options of what do I need to do now? I don't know how to do this. I reached out to a friend that I used to work with who is sober, and she lived across the country. But she immediately got me in contact with other people. And shockingly, one of those people was someone that we'd worked with, and I had no clue. So it was such a beautiful gift to have my Eskimo be someone that I knew, who I worked with and who I'd actually been friends with, but I kind of lost track of because she was living a different life. And I clearly was living a different life from what she wanted as well. But so that happened. And then I was able to quit one of my jobs that I'd been miserable for years at. I was able to tell one of my other jobs that I needed to take a leave of absence. And I didn't know what that looked like. And I didn't know how long it would be. And that job was so loving to me and completely wonderful. And they helped me and allowed me the grace to have that time off and get myself sober. And I'm still at that job actually today. I ended up going to my first meeting with my Eskimo who I'd worked with. My higher power put the speaker there that I needed to hear for that moment. I remember it was this woman who was heavily involved in, she was a showgirl in Las Vegas. And what a better example for me, because not that I was a showgirl or am a showgirl, but I think being in the bar world, you get very lost in things being totally acceptable that aren't really normalized to the rest of the world. So I'm hearing this woman speak and her talking about going to other bars and given the royal treatment. And that's how I kind of felt sometimes going to other bars. People knew me as the bartender at this place and the bartender at this place. So you're given free drinks all the time. And she was just the perfect person for me to have heard that night. I think in that moment, I realized she talked about going to detox, because at this point I was completely dependent on alcohol. I would get the shakes. If I didn't drink every 3 hours, I couldn't sleep longer than 3 or 4 hours because I had to drink again. I even had hallucinations. I had the feeling of bugs crawling under my skin. It was really horrible. I was given this woman to guide me that day as the speaker of this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and giving me the idea that I probably needed to go to a detox facility. And immediately from there, I remember gathering two of my friends and asking them to go with me to tell my parents that I had a problem and that I needed to go seek help. And they went with me and supported me so much. And then I think my first meeting was on a Tuesday. I went and told my parents on a Wednesday, and I went to detox on Thursday. And I remember being in the intake room. The irony now, or the really cool thing now, is that the place where I went to detox, I now have an H&I panel where I go to speak at the rehab facility that's there. And I tell my story to them, and I bring other sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous in to tell their story as well. And so it's like a cool little 180 for me, completely, completely different. And every time I'm there, I'm reminded of the time that I sat there waiting to go into detox. And I was terrified. I even remember almost leaving because I was starting to get angry that they weren't intaking me fast enough. I do want to give love to my best friend. She's like a sister to me, who was in the intake room with me because I did not want my parents in the intake room with me. I didn't want them to know, because they have you take a breathalyzer, and I didn't want my parents to know exactly how bad it was. And God bless this friend of mine who walked with me and was there for me and showed up for me many, many, many times before I got sober. She's an angel to me, and she's still very near and dear to my heart. So I went in the detox facility, had no idea what to expect. I didn't know if this was going to last. I didn't know what to expect. But again, I do believe that in this moment, my higher power was there with me, guiding me the whole time. I met some incredible people in there. And I remember the first day that I didn't feel sick, because I felt really awful the first day, and they had wanted me to go to group, and I couldn't. I was too sick. And the next day I went and I sat and I told them how I drank. And these two guys came up to me and sat down with me. And I remember we sat in this room after everybody else had left, and we just started talking about how we drank, and they were blown away. Like, oh my gosh, somebody drinks like me. And you know, that is what part of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's one person relating to another and realizing they're not alone. And I do think that even though we were not in AA, but we were in this treatment center, and we're talking to one another about how we drink and the things that we used to do and the feelings that are involved in our drinking and all these other things. They are the main reason, honestly, that I think I stayed in the detox facility. 5 days later, I was released, and I made a really tough decision. We choose our battles. We weigh things out. And I ended up moving back in with my parents at the age of 38, which for me was, again, a sign now that I had completely surrendered, completely. This is what we do. We are willing to go to any lengths. And I knew that that was going to be the safe space for me at that time, even though I kind of have a tumultuous relationship with my parents. I knew in that moment that I would be safe. So I ended up living with them for 6 months. The first day that I got out of detox, I went to my first AA meeting, which was right down the street. I still go to the same meeting to this day. The people there are completely loving, so wonderful. They could tell that I was not great. I know that I did not look great. I know that I was very fearful. I know that I looked like I had a lot of anxiety, which I did. But they were so kind and so wonderful and so welcoming to me. I ended up going into an outpatient program that was 5 days a week, 7 hours a day. And I like how we say in program, and I know I've heard you say this, and I love that you say this: we take what we need and we leave the rest. And for me, in the moment, being in that outpatient program, it was shockingly a really good, it was Kaiser's outpatient, and it was really good. And I ended up getting, in my opinion, one of the best therapists there. I knew then that I actually wanted this, that I wanted to do this. I was terrified, but I wanted to do it. And I did learn a lot there, and they were very encouraging about seeking out the 12 steps. I do believe some of the people there actually are some of us, and you can kind of tell who is and who isn't. They encourage people to go to AA meetings. And I think actually we even had to fill out a court card, but not a court card, or a Kaiser card filled out for reference there, so that they knew that we were going to 12-step meetings. So I will say I did not do this program perfectly at all. I feel like for me, it's been slow briety, but God knows what we need. And I think for me in the very beginning, it was slow briety, but I did a lot of the times what was suggested of me. People said, go to meetings, find a sponsor, get a service commitment. And I did those things. My first year, I had a coffee commitment at this huge meeting twice a week, actually. Twice a week in Los Angeles City, I would go to this meeting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon twice a week. And then other days I'd go to other meetings. But this meeting in particular was right before I had to go to work. So it was really important to me to get in a meeting before I went to work to bartend. I had a coffee commitment, and people sometimes don't understand the value of having service commitments because we have the meeting before the meeting. And for me, being a newcomer to AA and being incredibly timid and shy and anxious, it was important for me to be able to talk one-on-one with somebody else who was there in the building who had recovery, just to get out of my own head. And important for me to feel like I had some type of value and be held accountable to show up and make the coffee for 75 people twice a week. I was actually proud of that, and it made me feel good to be able to do that for other people. I did have a lot of problems finding a sponsor, and I want to reiterate this to anyone listening to this, if you're a newcomer and or if you have time, to really find a sponsor who is going to be available to you. I just really had a tough time finding a sponsor who would be available to me. And not only that, but, and I even tried to say this to my own sponsees, you know, I am not here to be your therapist. I'm not here to be your parent. I'm not here to tell you what to wear or who to date or any of those things. I'm just here to take you through the book, take you through the steps, and hopefully give you some of my experience on questions you might have and give you some suggestions on what you might be able to do to change whatever might be bothering you at that time. And if I don't have the answer, then I go to my sponsor and I ask them. And maybe I don't have the answer, and maybe no one has the answer, and maybe people seek outside help. And that's totally okay. I go to therapy, and I've gone to therapy through the majority of my recovery, and it's incredibly beneficial. But sponsors are just there to guide you through the steps and give you some suggestions and advice about what they've done. And, you know, I just kept really kind of finding sponsors who wouldn't stay in their own lane, but I didn't have the boundaries to be able to tell them that I didn't really like that or that that wasn't their place. But I know a lot differently now. So that's why I try to tell other people, you interview them too. It's not just them interviewing you. Make sure that they're going to put out the time for you, because I also had people who would not make the time for me. And I wanted recovery. And I think I had a sponsor who took me through the steps, and they didn't really take me through the big book. They didn't really take me through the 12 and 12. I'm not making any judgments, but for me, it's important for me to take my sponsees through the big book and through the 12 and 12, because I want to make sure that they understand what they're reading, because everybody's levels on education can be different, or their understanding, or it can be all different. And I just want to make sure that they kind of understand what we're reading and what we're doing. So then when they have a sponsee, that they are able to carry the message in a similar fashion. I had a sponsor who, quote unquote, took me through the steps, but we didn't really go through the big book. It was very, in my opinion, no offense, it was pretty half-assed. I realized immediately that I needed to find a new sponsor, and I found somebody who was willing to take me through the big book and through the 12 steps so that I thoroughly understood what I was doing. And that was so wonderful to me, because now I do the same with my sponsees. Let's see, things that I have learned along the way. There's so much. I think in the beginning of this, I don't know. I think I thought for some reason that the growth stops at like a year. I don't know why I thought that, but I've realized the more that you keep doing the work, it's just, you keep growing and growing and growing. There's a lot, like, I kind of hate the saying, but it's so true. It's like peeling the onion. We do. It's literally year after year, I discover that I have learned more about myself and learned more about things that I don't like, or just grown in immense ways. And it really kind of blows me away. I also want to talk about fear, because when I got here, I think my journey with God has evolved. And I want people to remember that your journey with recovery can evolve and your journey with God can evolve, because my understanding of God, or the God of my understanding, has grown in so many different ways. Like I was saying before, I talked about a higher power when I got here that I didn't even know that I had, who was guiding me in this very beautiful way. And I think once I got here, whether I believed it or not, I think in the beginning there was, you know, this acronym, the gift of desperation. I completely had the gift of desperation that I didn't even know that I had. So I think for a while that was my God. And then as I started to stay in the rooms and I started to trust other people in the rooms, I think for a while that was my God, the group of drunks. Because to me, there is a type of spirituality being with another alcoholic. Me being able to see this other person who has a longer amount of time of sobriety than I have, and seeing them be actually really happy, joyous, and free, as they say, being blown away by that. And that gives me hope. That gave me hope in the beginning that I could live my life in a way that they do, because of the work that they've done, and they have a God of their understanding, and they're relying on that God, and they're letting go every day, and they're letting go of things that aren't serving them anymore. And to me, that is a type of spirituality, having hope from another person and having those people there to tell me, because in the very beginning, I had such a hard time. And some people even told me, I didn't think you were going to make it. But having them there to tell me when I told them, I have so much anxiety and fear. I have so much fear and I don't know how, when is this going to go away? When will this stop? And every single one of them would say to me, I promise you, it will stop. It will stop. It will lessen. Maybe it might not stop, but it will lessen. It will dissipate. I'll learn how to deal with it better. I'll learn from all the tools that we're given in this program. I'll learn how to be able to deal with that anxiety. And then I remember, I don't know when it happened. I do not know when it happened. But one day I remember thinking to myself, that feeling isn't there anymore. That anxiety that I had has kind of left me. And it was this beautiful feeling of like, oh my gosh, I have some recovery, even though I knew I had recovery, but it had changed. And just like these people had said, things had changed. And so back to the God thing, I'm kind of going all over the place here. So I kind of had this resistance to the word God, because I was very religious when I was younger and I didn't want to have that God anymore as my higher power. And I just kept associating it with the religious God that I used to have. And one time when I was the secretary of a meeting, I had my Eskimo come and speak, and I probably heard it before, but for some reason it hit me that day when she said it. She said, you do not have to define your God or put a picture of your God up for you to see. It can just be, your God can just be something that you pray to every day, and you have a belief in and have the faith that this God is going, or this higher power is going to change your life. And that was just a huge moment for me. It was like a freeing moment for me. I was then able to pray to a God of my understanding, because it had finally made sense to me. Oh, it's not this religious God. It's my God. It's this beautiful, loving, graceful guide of a God for me in my life that I pray to every day. That was just a beautiful thing. And from then on, it's been so much easier for me to pray to a God of my understanding. And sometimes it changes. Sometimes it's the universe. And I don't know, all these different, the Great Spirit and all the, like it says in the Big Book, it's changed over time. But I just pray to a God of my understanding every day, and it makes my life better. I know I had a lot of fear for a long time, and I don't know that I was turning my will and my life over to the care of God all the time. I don't know that we do that always on a consistent basis, but I do remember a time when I had about 2.5 years and my sponsor looking at me and saying, "You are the most fearful person I've ever met in my life." And I think God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves, because a series of events happened, and then I quickly had to take immediate action instead of living in this place of fear that I like to dwell in all the time. And I think that was a huge turning point for me in my recovery, where I realized it was okay to sometimes have this fear, but also being able to turn it over to God and have the faith that God has me. And I feel a whole lot better now in going through that experience, realizing that I don't need to live in this place of fear, and that I can rely on a God of my understanding. So many things have changed. I have better boundaries, way better boundaries. I had no idea when I was doing my fourth and fifth step that a huge part of my resentments were because I couldn't set boundaries with people. That's been a huge part of my recovery. I would get angry at other people because they didn't do what I wanted to do, but I never told them I was upset, or I didn't set a boundary, and now I have a resentment toward them. So that's one huge thing for me that's gotten so much better. I guess maybe at the end of this, I just want to say, sometimes I get in this space, even in recovery, and I think some of us do, we get in this space of sometimes going back to the spiritual malady of being restless, irritable, and discontented, and having these resentments, or having fear, or having depression, and it just gets so big in our heads. And even praying sometimes might not relieve some of that, but maybe the difference is now that I know this is not going to stay. This is not going to remain forever. I know tomorrow is going to be a new day. It's so interesting to me, because then sometimes the next day I'm feeling so much better and so happy and so much different from the day that I did before. And then I like laugh at myself. And I always think of rule 62, which is don't take yourself too seriously. That's one thing I always like to remember. So I think that's it.
Thank you, Melanie. I love how you ended that, because I do it both ways. So when I'm really restless, irritable, and discontent, and it's really big in my head, and I'm basically dramatizing whatever is happening, or not happening fast enough, and then I flip to the other side a couple days later or a week later, and I look back at something I wrote or a phone call, and I think, God, I'm such a baby, and I feel sheepish for my dramatic behavior.
Right.
I do it the other way, too. When I'm in a really good and happy mood, which I normally am, I'm normally loud and enthusiastic, and when I'm grumpy, I see the happy Tara, and I'm annoyed by her, too. Goes both ways.
That's hilarious. So, it's true. I think I do that, too.
Rule 62. That's the hardest part of editing these episodes is having to listen to my own self. I don't totally self-love yet, but I'm working on it.
Aw.
You know.
I know. I hear you.
We got sober around the same time.
We did?
Well, yeah. I mean, I stopped drinking, but I got sober. I had the gift of desperation 2 years after my last drink.
Really?
And so mine is 2/24/16.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I love it.
Well, thank you so much for your story. I just jumped into Tara stuff, but I just love, I love Rule 62, and I love how you ended your share with that. You had mentioned, and I don't know if you cut the story out because of time concerns or if you didn't want to go into details, but at 2.5 years sober, you had something was going on and you had to take immediate action. Did you want to talk about that or do you want to leave it high level?
I'll just leave it high level. Okay. It wasn't anything really drastic is the thing. You know, it was like I got into a car accident and I needed to get a new job. I was in so much fear, like so much fear. And you know what the funny thing is? I literally just gave advice to my friend today about not being, cause she's going to go back to a job that, well, she's probably going to go back to like waiting tables, and she's older now and she's in a lot of fear. And I was like, look, I've been where you are. I get it. And if I was her cheerleader today, because sometimes we just get so locked up in our head of like, I'm not good enough. And that's where I was. But also at that time, I think I was also struggling with trying to figure out God right there then too, which sounds horrible, but we go through these journeys of finding God when we find God or whatever we're willing to see as God or pray to every day. And I just was not, it's like, where was God, Melanie? I guess if I had been my sponsor, then I would, and maybe my sponsor did say that to me, but maybe I couldn't hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved that part. I mean, I can tell you're a panel speaker because there's so many positive lessons learned and best practices throughout your entire share. What is the expression from my Eskimo?
It is basically the person who takes you to AA. Technically, maybe I had two Eskimos because it would be the girl in Chicago who led me to the person, but it's the person who leads you to AA.
So that's an AA thing?
Yes.
Your Eskimo?
Yeah.
How have I not heard this? Is this an LA thing?
Maybe. I think there's one time, maybe it was in a story that somebody talked about an Eskimo. I think I Googled it one time.
Okay.
And I don't remember where it came from. So maybe I shouldn't have used that terminology because people probably won't understand. But
yeah. No, in context, you explained it in context and you mentioned it like three times. So by the time everyone gets to hear this part of the share, they'll know what it was. I was just wanted the history.
You know what's really cool too? Remember that guy that I talked about, the general manager?
Yes.
Who, he's sober. He got sober before I did.
Wow.
I've had so many, oh my gosh, I've never worked in a place where more people have gotten sober. There's like eight of us, probably more. And it's like one guides the next. I had this person and then I helped someone else who we used to work with get here. It's incredible. It's really cool. And the crazier thing is the one that I guided to get here, we both went to the quote unquote graduation of our GM when he got out of rehab. They have like a graduation thing, but he stayed in the program. He's committed to it. I reach out to him every now and then. It's so cool.
AA is the new black.
Yeah.
It was more funny in my head. Okay. So 7 years. I mean, we're not at 7.5 yet, but we're coming up on it. So 7 years in a few months, you talked about growth and you were talking about things you learned along the way. And the more you work, the more you keep growing. What was Melanie say pre-COVID and now? Where are your big growth areas?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I did kind of already talk about it, but boundaries.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Boundaries, that has been huge for me. I had no idea how people were talking to me, people were treating me. When I got sober, I left one of my jobs because I was like, what is going on? Has this been happening? What, like, where have I been? I've been drunk the whole time. This is how they're talking to me. I remember going to HR and it was like horrible sexual harassment. I work in a bar and I've worked with all men and I can handle a lot, but once you turn it on me and you're talking about my anatomy and disgusting things, no. And I allowed myself to be spoken to like that. And I went to HR and they did nothing. And I'm like, peace, I'm done. I have eliminated people from my life who are abusive. I will not do it. Things that are no longer serving me. I mean, I just left a job. And I see my younger coworkers and they're allowing themselves to be treated like that because the money is good. And I'm like, you deserve better than this. You deserve a place of employment that wants to make sure that you're safe. Yeah, it's just changed a lot. It's times like this when I do things like this, I really realize how much I've changed. And then even this morning, I made an amends to somebody and she was so grateful. And I'm like, oh my God, who am I? Who am I? It's cool. Oh my gosh. Me years ago would have just dismissed it and been like, oh, you know, she deserved it or whatever. She doesn't care. No, my relationships matter to me. The people who are in my life right now, they matter a lot. And I want to keep those relationships intact and make sure that I'm treating those people with value and the way that they should be treated. And it's reciprocated. The people I choose to have in my life treat me well. Yeah.
Your friend that asked you about your drinking when you admitted the truth to her.
Yes.
She was a normie, yes?
She is a normie.
Does she know is a normie. The significance in your life that she plays?
She absolutely does.
Okay.
She absolutely does. And I tell her all the time. For my sobriety birthday this year, she didn't know that was my sobriety birthday, but we actually had a baby shower for her that day, and she found out later that it was my sobriety birthday because the person that I led, the coworker that I told you about, who I led to sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous or guided or whatever. That person got me a sobriety present. And she ended up asking, she said, what was that? And I said, well, it's actually my sobriety birthday. And she said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I said, look, I said, this is the best gift that I could possibly give you. I said, you have no idea. It's like the things that you did for me. You know, she knows. Both her and her husband, they are so dear to me. But, you know, that's what we do. We get sober and we're able to show up for people and give them things that we show them how much they mean to us. So, yeah.
That's very sweet. Is there anything that you're thinking of now or that you left out of your story that you'd like to share?
I don't think so. Oh, well, I mean, maybe the only thing I would say is that I don't know, for some reason I always brush over this, but I lost my childhood best friend early in sobriety. She was already very sick. It actually broke my heart that the last time that I saw her, granted, she was really inebriated too because she was super sick. I was drunk the last time I saw her. I went up to San Luis Obispo basically to say goodbye to her. And I spent the weekend with her and I was drunk the whole time because I had to be, but I wish that I could have been there, been able to be my sober self and be authentic because she ended up dying about 1.5 months after I got sober. And it was devastating to me, but I got through it. And her parents even told me because I had told her that I'd gotten sober, and they told me she was so proud of you. And so no way was I going to blow sobriety, something that she was proud of me for, on her leaving this earth. She wouldn't want me to do that. But we can get through anything. We really can.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to pivot to our last question for the alcoholic listening, still suffering. What final message would you like to leave with them?
Ooh. Well, I remember thinking that there wasn't a different life out there for me. I remember thinking that my life couldn't be different in sobriety, that my life wouldn't be good in sobriety, that I would never be happy ever again, that I'd never have fun ever again. I remember thinking this in my first meeting and watching all these women laugh and, you know, have a good time. And I looked around and I was like, they're faking this. This is not real. Now that I'm on the other side, I realize that's completely untrue. Meanwhile, I was locked in my own prison of complete despair and depression. You're a slave to your addiction, to alcoholism. I couldn't leave and go anywhere. You can't show up for people. But there's a different life. I've experienced a completely different life. I had a birthday party a few years after I got sober. It blew my mind. I had sober people there, and I had my friends who still drank. I had a DJ, and guess who the people on the dance floor were? All my sober friends, all of them. And all the people drinking were too afraid to get up and dance until they'd had enough drinks. That's the perfect example to me of sobriety. It's living life to its fullest, whether it be good or bad, and being able to get through all of it. There is so much joy and so much happiness in sobriety. And you remember everything. It's great.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.